This is Conversations About Foster Care.
In this first season, join our conversation about transitions, removal, and coping with change, trauma, and grief.
The system is made up of all of us, so let's talk about how we can do better by our kids. Hello, it's Marika. I'll go first. It's Marika.
It's Kurt.
This is our second episode. We're talking about when it's time to move.
Welcome back.
Yeah, welcome back. So we thought in this episode we would start with the most important person in the foster care system, and that is, funnily enough, the child, though we won't be speaking to a child today. We're going to be talking to a grown-up who has come through the foster care system, someone who in foster care circles is called former foster youth, and that's my friend Jean. We're going to be hearing from her a little bit in a few minutes. We're going to listen to an interview I did with Jean on the phone. And
she's an adult now.
She is a grown-up, I confirm. Yes. But before we get into the interview, we're just going to take a couple of minutes to talk about the basics of a transition. What is that? And when it's time to move, what happens?
So, yeah, the transition could be directed by the court. It could be directed by the agency. I guess there's a whole myriad of other reasons why or how and when a kid can be directed to be moved between the foster parents and birth family or birth family and...
Yeah, not just the foster parents to birth family. It could be from birth family into foster care itself. It could be from a foster family to an adoptive family or into a kinship placement. Mm-hmm. Again, we're from New York State, so we can only really speak for the rules that we know of in our state. It could be different in yours. But the transition could be super fast or it might happen progressively. So we've known instances even within our state of those two things happening at opposite extremes. Our agency cited one example where the decision had been made for a child to leave a long-term foster family and go to live with a cousin, and that cousin lived completely in a different state, and they picked the child up the very next day and they were put on an airplane and went to live with this cousin that they'd never even had a visit with. So that's a really extreme example of a sudden transition, and one that, you know, Kurt and I, one of the reasons we've made this podcast is
that's bad.
That's really bad. Like, that's going to cause trauma.
And the system doesn't have any standardized practices for how this stuff can happen. And that's kind of really the whole reason behind this whole podcast is we were really shocked at the fact that there's no standard practices or direction from the agency as how to do this. And
I think it should come from higher up than an agency. It needs to come from the child psychologist that the government speak to and say, hey, this is abusive that we're moving children so quickly. You know, there's studies now that are showing that the trauma of a transition can be as bad or worse than the neglect that brought a child into the foster system in the first place. So the fact that we don't have any industry standard practices for how a child is removed from one home and put in another and how we can make that clearer, better, more loving for a child is why we're here.
Yeah. Can you hear that? We're obviously in New York City.
We are not.
This is our second episode.
Our listeners.
We're in Dallas, Texas.
We are in Dallas. We're in our hotel.
Kind of a long story, but we're not going to go into that. Sorry if you hear traffic noise. One of those papers that you mentioned that we found incredibly interesting and thought-provoking is called The Children Were Fine, written by two child psychologists in Britain. And you can find it at thechildrenwerefine.co.uk. There's a whole website and you can read the paper and their opinions on the paper and stuff.
Yeah, this was a long-term study where they tracked the psychological fallout from kids being moved from one home to another and in cases where they had contact with families on both sides of that transition and where they didn't and how those transitions were handled. And not surprisingly, they discovered that the kind of Band-Aid approach that came from really a generation ago but are still in place today, which is we just pick the kid up and we put them in the new home and we don't have contact because it'll just be easier for everyone if we all just stay where we are and that kid will just get that time to settle into their new home and it'll be easier for them. It's been found to be not actually that helpful and, in fact, causing trauma down the track to children as they get older.
Yeah. Ricky and I, even whilst being foster parents, were saying to each other, I wonder what would happen if our kiddo was taken from us and given back to the birth family or the extended family member. What would be the best thing for us? Is it better for us to just not have any contact with that kid?
Even we, you know, we're always thinking about what would be the best thing for kiddo. Would it be better if we just weren't around? Would that be confusing? Like, I think we thought what everyone kind of thinks. And it took us reading this paper and doing a lot more homework and research to realize that that is the actual opposite of what is helpful for a child to understand and process a transition.
It's certainly, I think, the natural thing to feel and think. And we certainly thought that. But yeah, reading this paper, understanding a lot more. If you listen to the rest of our podcast, this is basically what we talk about the whole time, is that we've learned that it is far better and far more important for that child from their point of view to see their adults around them stay together in a loving way and transition their place where they live from one place to the other without sudden chops of never seeing that person again and wondering whatever happened to the person who she thought was mum and dad.
Yeah. And the reason that this is problematic is because the study also talks about how children who go through a transition suddenly, they tend to be quite compliant and they tend to present as a really well-behaved child. So the social worker goes around once a month and goes, yeah, they're doing really great. It's all working out. And that child is just repressing this. They're trying to be very well-behaved because they've adjusted to a new set of rules maybe, or, you know, it's a completely different home environment. But the evidence of trauma is now coming out down the track with foster youth. Will they be former foster youth by then, in their teenage years, exhibiting, you know, very low self-esteem or perhaps exhibiting other behaviours as a result of childhood trauma, like wanting to take drugs or cut themselves or, you know, all of those things that we hope no kid ever goes through. So this is why this stuff is really important. And without further ado, because we've been waffling on for a while, we want to introduce my friend Jean, who is a former foster youth and is an amazing woman. And here she is talking about her experiences.
Hi, Jean.
Hi, Ricky. How are you?
I'm good. It's lovely to hear from you.
Yes, same.
I'm calling you today because we're doing this series about transitions in foster care and talking about how moving around from a home to a home, whether it's from a foster home back to parents or whether it's from foster to an adoptive family or whether it's into the system initially, how all those changes can impact a kiddo and how that trauma can negatively impact them. And I knew that you were in foster care yourself and I wanted to hear a little bit about that. How old were you when you came into care?
I was 9 years old when I was first placed in foster care.
Okay, and how many homes did you go into?
So I was placed in foster care with my three other siblings, and mm-hmm. because there was four of us that were moved from my mother's care at the time, we were moved quite often because the homes weren't really equipped to take in four kids, and they initially wanted to keep us together. So we went through at least eight homes over the course of a couple of months.
Wow, over a couple of months?
Yeah, part of the problem was the very first home that we were placed in was actually really abusive. And so as a result, all of the children who were placed in that home were removed. And there was something like six kids in that home when we first, it was a very rural area in Northern Ontario. And so part of the problem is that there's in rural areas, there just aren't a lot of foster homes available. And so it can be difficult to place kids. In fact, the first night we actually slept at the school because there was nowhere for us to stay. And then they moved us to this first home, which had a bunch of kids in there, but there was also, they were stretched thin in terms of care workers. So nobody had actually gone to that house in a while to see what was happening there. And so a couple of days, and when we first reported the abuse, we actually also weren't removed. It was really horrific. Actually, we were even working for them. It was really bad, the very first home. We were lucky after that home. We were placed in really lovely homes. It was challenging, though, because in some ways, the kinder the people were, the more difficult it was for us because we knew it was temporary. So, and they did eventually separate us, which meant that we could stay longer, but that was challenging because we were apart from each other.
Of course. What was your, you know, you're a 9-year-old, what was your cognition at that point of what was happening? Like how, you know, you obviously understand that you're being separated from your parents and going into a stranger's home. Like, do you remember how you felt and how you processed that? Because that's just such an enormous change. And I imagine it probably happened quite quickly. Like you suddenly just put in another place.
Yeah, I mean, when the thing that was the most traumatic for us is that we didn't really understand what was happening and why we were being removed from my mother's care. She was still our mom. So we knew that we needed help, but we didn't know that that meant that we wouldn't get to see her. And my dad at the time was actually not living with us because he was working and not living at home. And we just wanted help. I mean, we went to our teachers and said, we recognized things had gotten out of control and we needed help. And to this day, I think in some ways, the shock of being removed without any contact whatsoever with our mother was almost worse than what we were experiencing, only because, you know, still our mom and we didn't know any better. And then because we were also placed in an abusive environment. So, and we were, you know, very, very rural, big farmhouse in the middle of nowhere. So it was just a really scary experience. And nobody answered our questions. I mean, people would talk to each other, but not to us. So I remember,
that's,
you know,
horrible.
Yeah, I remember very vividly, you know, sitting in the car with the caseworker, talking to a police officer. Caseworker explained to the police officer where we were going and that we were going to stay there, and they weren't sure what to do. And everybody seemed really stressed out, but we had no idea, like no clue what was happening. So it was very scary.
Yeah. One of the reasons we're making this podcast, and one of the reasons it's the most important thing that we talk to former foster youth and hear perspectives like yours in this series, is because, you know, recent studies are coming out now that the trauma of being suddenly moved and the trauma of transitions for kids can be more lasting, more impactful than the actual neglect that brings mm-hmm. them into the system in the first mm-hmm. place. And that's mm-hmm. something that I feel like the foster system and caseworkers and the whole foster community are really not giving enough attention and resources to, and how traumatizing it can be for a young person to be moved, and if that's not explained, if it's not handled sensitively, how damaging that can be. Do you have any examples, any like positive examples of how perhaps when you were moving, maybe there was some transitional practices put into place? Did you ever have some grown-ups in your situation advocating for changing your home gradually, or perhaps explaining things, or giving you a life book or anything that was put into place so that you understood what was happening a bit more?
Well, the last place that we stayed at, which we were there the longest, I want to say we were there for about 4 months, the family was really patient with us. I mean, they sat us down and they explained that they were going to try to be in our life afterwards, which for us, no one had even said that before. And our caseworker was, the fact that she stayed with us through everything, and she did move us from that first house, and she got all the other kids moved as well. And sometimes you get different caseworkers as well every time you change houses, but she fought to stay with us through everything. And she also, we eventually went back into my father's care. My dad ended up getting full custody. It just took a while, but, she kept visiting us at the school. And the last family, their own kids also communicated with us for a little while afterwards, because we went to the same high school. Mm-hmm. And in small towns, that's really hard if you have a friendship or if you're close with one of the siblings or people who stay living there. So I think that can make a big difference, is if there is ongoing contact. I do think that the hardest part, you know, sometimes the thing that people forget is that when you're used to abuse and trauma, it's actually scarier to experience warmth and peace in some ways, because you don't want to desire that, and it's really destabilizing. Yeah. And so when it's taken from you, it can make it really difficult to function, to make sense of your world afterwards. And I do think that that's kind of what happened to us when we were removed from the last home and placed in my father's care, that final transition, only because we left a very, and the other thing to remember is just pure class issues, right? A lot of times people who are offering foster homes are much better off than the families, even if they end up getting custody again, which in most cases they do. And for a child or a teenager who's being put into an environment where they have their own room for the first time, or they have access to money, and a lot of kids are actually given a weekly stipend too. So, I mean, you're given money that you've never had before. It's very, very difficult to process the fact that that's not really yours, and that your status really hasn't changed, and that you're going to have to go back into working and providing for your family again the way that you might have from, you know, I started working at 10 years old. So, you know, it's difficult to kind of make sense of all of those changes in a way without, you know, support. So like I said, our caseworker did make a difference, and the last family made a real effort. But I think that there's a lot more work that can be done to address how harmful. There's actually a pilot program happening in Canada where caseworkers and volunteer families are going into the homes and staying with the families rather than removing them. And I think pilot programs like that could be quite beneficial, just to look at it from a different perspective and see how families can be supportive in ways that allow them to stay in their environments if they can.
Yes. Yeah, that sounds great. I'm going to look that up.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Without getting into that, I just was so grateful that you're willing to be so generous with sharing what I'm sure are, you know, painful experiences or a bit uncomfortable to share. And I don't want to be insensitive to your siblings, but perhaps you can talk a little bit about, you know, how did changing homes and leaving families more than once, how did that impact you guys, and what sort of coping mechanisms did you each have, and was there any lasting trauma that you feel like you or your siblings have taken into adulthood that you've had to deal with?
Mm-hmm. So I have actually have a lot of brothers and sisters. I have 8 brothers and sisters. I have 3 who are from the same mom and dad, and I have 4 from different, so 2 from my mother's previous relationship, and then 3 more after that. So my younger siblings haven't been in foster care. My older 2, so 6 of us in total, went through foster care. And we each experienced it differently. I can't speak to their experiences, but what I can say is that without any doubt, it was very traumatic for each of us. And I think the way that I've seen it manifest itself in me is just a very intense urge for acceptance and difficulty around accepting myself and in my marriage as well, you know, with my husband just constantly feeling a need to have more reassurance than perhaps I should have. And in my career, you know, no matter how many accolades I might get, I feel like there is a part of me that is constantly seeking belonging and acceptance in a way that's very much tied to that first feeling of shame that comes when you are invited into a new home. And I do have a real issue around like financial insecurity of any kind. If I experience it, it's difficult for me to manage. And I've personally struggled with depression as well, depression and anxiety. And I do think that there's something very, that experience of a child not having any place to go, you know, that really stays with you in a way that I think is just fundamentally unjust. And I think that there needs to be more support around both foster parents that want to offer permanent homes, because I do think that that's something that needs to happen. There needs to be more permanent homes available for people in transition, and then also more support around the systemic issues that are causing kids to be in this position, because I do think there's also a lot of parents who are good parents who their children get taken from them and then that causes irreparable damage. Because later on, after we were all already in college, you know, my younger sister also was placed in foster care from my father's care twice and then returned. And in almost all cases, that is what happens. It's a temporary removal. And yeah. In the instance of a temporary removal, I don't really understand what the state sees as that as being beneficial long term, because very rarely is there going to be any significant change to serious issues. And we know that these issues are not, they're not happening in a vacuum. They're happening as a result of poverty. They're happening as a result of lack of access to adequate social support systems. They're happening as a result of lack of access to proper medical assistance, yep. to family doctor, mm-hmm. and pediatricians, because a good pediatrician could catch this and pay attention to it as well and provide support to the yep. families. So, I mean, I think that, you know, there needs to be definitely a more holistic approach to the problem.
Absolutely. And in your case, not to sound like I'm trying to paint a fairy tale, but mm-hmm. in your case, the system worked. Your dad was able to reunify with you, and you got the outcome mm-hmm. that we hope for all foster kids, which is that their parents are able to get some support and are able to parent helpfully. So can you tell us a little bit about how it felt, you know, to know that you were going to reunify with your dad and what that final transition was like?
I wish I could say that it was a fairy tale. It definitely was not. It was really hard. We had visitation with my dad, but my dad was an alcoholic before he got custody, and he had to prove his sobriety for quite some time. And we, mm-hmm. by the time we reunited with him, he felt like a stranger. And it had been a lot of
happening. How long have you been in care? Sorry to interrupt you there. How long yeah. have you been in the system by now?
So over a year, and okay. a lot of different homes. And he was visiting us on the weekends, but it took a while, you know, and he couldn't see us. If he had to be sober, I think, for 4 months or something like that before he could see us the first time. And, I'll never, you know, the first thing we grew up in subsidized housing. So, basically the ghetto is what, that's what the ghetto is. You know, it's where government housing. And we never had furniture or anything like that, but I never really noticed our own poverty before because it was my home. And yeah. when I remember when we went back into the house, it was like seeing it as a stranger would see it for the first time. You know, I saw how bare it was. I saw that our table was falling apart. I saw that I noticed I didn't have a bed. I noticed that I didn't have clothes. My dresser was old. I noticed that the fridge was empty. That we didn't have a microwave. I noticed all the things that I didn't notice before, and I experienced shame in a completely different way. And my dad was also ashamed and scared, and it was hard. That the fact that I missed the old family, I missed the comforts of the previous home, I missed the carpet, I missed the nice couch and the TV, and I missed having two parents sit down with me and check in with me about my homework and all those things. And there wasn't any immediate follow up in the month after. So that first month that first month was really, really hard. I don't know that it really got that much better. I was very lucky to have my dad in my life and very proud of him for getting sober. And we were really very lucky because all my siblings and I were all very gifted academically and athletically. So we all got academic and athletic scholarships, which meant that we had our own lives and our own money pretty quickly as we got older. But, but I mean, for people who are struggling, so I had teachers who believed in me as well. You know, I had lots of other support systems outside of the home. And then I moved out when I was 17. All of us moved out pretty early. So, I mean, I don't know that it was the perfect kind of return, but I think there should have been more support, more ongoing support, more parenting support in particular. One of the things I find very bizarre is that there isn't any parenting resources or education provided to the parents either before or after removal. The social worker I remember checked on us, I think about 6 months after, and then the parents checked in on us by phone.
The foster parents, your lost family.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. But it was more the siblings because they had kids and they were in the same school. But I do think there's a lot of caution, right? Everybody's very afraid of what to say, and that kind of makes it worse. You know, there is definitely an obvious fear, especially in small towns where everyone knows but doesn't actually say what they know. It just draws more attention to the fact that you feel strange and you feel like an outsider because you're still just a kid, just like everybody else.
Yeah. That's so interesting. It hadn't occurred to me that, you know, being in a small town versus being in a city could really impact that experience. I hadn't thought of that, so that's a really interesting aspect. Mm-hmm. I've got one last question, and I just wanted to ask, as a former foster youth, like what is the one thing that you wish that the grown-ups had done or that you think they could have done to have made all those changes easier for you to process and to have less trauma?
I think that one-on-one time, you know, I think in my situation, I came from a family, a really big family with a lot of kids, and then we were always placed in homes with other children that were present. And I do think that's a lot of kids are in that situation just because of the limited resources. And I was very shy. It was very quiet. And on the surface, you would think I didn't want to engage, but I just didn't know how. No one had really talked to me. But if I had had more kind of set aside one-on-one time, if the foster parents, it was an obligation that they spend an hour with each of us, or if there is a parent that's spending a whole hour, because there's no intentional time. Like there's no caseworker that says you have to spend an hour with the child, or a therapist.
Yeah, it's emotional support.
Yeah.
Emotional support is something that we talk about feeding the kids and putting a roof over their head, but we don't talk about how important it is to have that emotional support. That's a really good point.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because what makes the difference is feeling like someone's taking an interest in you. Like the thing that really, I think, changed my life was my teachers. I had teachers who took an interest in me and really wanted to know who I was and wanted to hear what I had to say. And that time, I mean, it's invaluable, just giving the time, giving your time.
Thank you so much for chatting to me, Jane. I just think I think you're an incredible person. Oh. And I'm really honoured that you would share your story. I'm actually quite teary because I'm just knowing you a little bit. I'm just really proud of the kind of person you are now, and I'm sure your dad must be very proud of you. And that's all.
Well, thank you for saying that. I really appreciate it. And thank you for doing this. I think it's really important.
Yeah, it's good that we have conversations about how we can, how all of us in the foster community can try and do a bit better by these kids.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, what I really take away from that interview is just how important it is for all of us in the foster community to listen first and foremost to the voices of foster kids. The former foster youth and the kids in the system themselves. Like, they are the people who are in this situation. They are the people who are going through it and can come at it years later like Jean can, with a lot more perspective and insight for us to be able to learn from. It's so important.
Mm-hmm. One thing I got from that interview was just that reminder about the amount of group homes out there. And, you know, we privileged and in the position where we had one foster daughter coming to our home, and we gave her all our attention for all the time she was with us. But a lot of foster kids go through the experience of being in group homes where, you know, they're in potentially a house where a person is potentially a great person, but they've basically got a system where there's 8 or 10 kids in their home in bunk beds.
And not a lot of one-on-one emotional contact or emotional connection, I guess.
Yeah, they're doing their best to put a roof over their heads and feed them and look after them, but there isn't the time, there isn't the ability for that person to give such personal connection with each of their foster kids that are in their home. And as heard there with Jean, that then meant she turned to her teachers. And
and can we hear it for the teachers? Because they really saved the day. And I love that Jean got that, you know, that attention, and that those teachers obviously really fostered her natural gifts. I mean, that's so cool. We come from teachers, so we're very biased. We've got lots of teachers in our family.
Shout out for the teachers.
We love the teachers.
But, you know, without those teachers, Jean talks there about not having a personal, someone take a personal interest in her, and that is a huge thing as you grow up to maintaining a self-confidence and all those things. So I thought that was wonderful.
The other thing that I really noticed in her case, and throughout this podcast series, we're going to do 8 episodes, and we're going to talk to lots of different people, but one of the things we really noticed in all the people we interview is that some of them had a really consistent caseworker, like Jean said that her family did, and some of them don't. And we were one of the people who really didn't. Our kiddo did not have the same caseworker the whole way through, and in fact had no caseworker for several months. And it's just, you know, it's no one's fault. It's just the circumstances of how things can play out if people resign or things get switched out. But the impact on a case and the impact, it was really insightful for me to hear that it really directly impacted Jean's processing and Jean's experience of going through the system, to know that that one grown-up stuck with her case really helped her to know what was happening. And that's incredible. Like, I hadn't even thought about it, of course, at the age she was. That would have meant a lot for her to see that one consistent caseworker whenever she went to visits or whenever she had to go to court or whatever. Like, and to not have that can be really detrimental, I think.
Absolutely. In our case, you know, we were in situations in court where we had a new caseworker who was in court being asked questions about the case, and we were sitting in the back of the courtroom knowing the answers, and because the caseworker didn't know the answers, the court didn't hear the answers to basic questions. And guys, like, you know, that's pretty, like, the court is what decides.
It's failing the child.
It's deciding this kid's fate, and because our new person is here, they don't really know the case. Like, that's just, you know, nightmare.
One thing we wanted to talk about in our experience with our transition is we had this thing that was really great, I thought, and it was called the Final Family Conference. I don't know how it is for other people in other states, but we did have a few family conferences through our kiddo's case, and it was where we got an opportunity to be in the room, often with, initially it was with her birth mum, and then it became with this extended family member who eventually got custody of her. But when it was finally decided that she would leave our home, the judge said around 2 weeks, and we all got into a room, and it was an opportunity to all sit around a table and talk about how the transition would go forward. It was an opportunity for everyone to ask questions and to get on the same page about, I mean, we really just said to the extended family member, you have our full support, and we just want to make sure this is as loving and as trauma-free and as, you know, positive for kid as we can possibly make it. And anything we can do to help support that, let's all just be on the same team about it. There was a woman there and we kept referring to her as the mediator, though she had some fancy, she was the such and such representative or something.
A person that wasn't part of the agency, that was a separate, what do you call that word, individual or...
Her job was to go around to I guess, for want of a better word, mediate and represent, but she didn't. She was impartial.
Impartial was the word I was looking for. Thank you.
We got there in the end together.
Yeah, thank you. She was an impartial person to come in, and she talked to us to try and help us manage the decision-making for how the transition would happen. And what we were kind of surprised by is that we were bringing these things to the table and talking about things like the paper we referred to earlier, The Children Were All Right, and The Children Were All Right is a movie.
It is a great movie.
Yeah, The Children Were Fine. But we were suggesting these things and the agency didn't seem to kind of, they were kind of saying, well, what do you guys want to do? As opposed to saying, this is what should happen in
the transition. This is what would be great for this child at this age, in this particular part of their development, at this particular stage of having been with you for X amount of time. In our expert opinion, this is how we think it should go. Like, none of that happened. Yeah. So we were standing there going, well, you know, yeah, we could do a sleepover this weekend. That's cool. Do you mind if we pack her this? Or, you know, and all sort of muddling through it. And at the time, it was very pleasant and the extended family was extremely open to working with us to make all that go smoothly, so there was no problem at all. But it did stun us that the agency workers really didn't weigh in much at all in terms of helping structure that for us.
Yeah, I guess it reminded us that probably what they're used to is fighting factions and the foster parents being adversarial to the kid being taken away from them, which is understandable. We certainly felt that, although
it's
we put that aside.
But it's also not, you know, at the end of the day, we all have to put aside our egos and our feelings and make sure that the kid is the person in the situation who is looked after. And it's really hard when you're potentially transitioning a child into a home that perhaps you – this was not our experience, by the way, but I know of foster families where they've been transitioning into a home that they fundamentally don't think is in the best interests of their child because of safety or because of, you know, other complicated circumstances. I think that would be really hard, but I would like to think that we are all capable of shelving whatever those judgments are or whatever those ego thoughts and feelings are and make sure that we just love on that family because that's the child's family, you know, and that's where they're going to be and you have to just step up and help them. How can you support them? And, oh, that's what I think anyway.
Okay, well, that's about everything for today. We thank you for listening.
Thank you, Jean, for talking to us.
Thanks, Jean. If you'd like to rate us on iTunes, that helps us get known out there in the internet. Please log in with your iTunes account or wherever you get your podcasts. Give us a 5-star review. Say some nice things about us. If you have anything negative to say, please email us at conversationsaboutfostercare@gmail.com. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening. We encourage you to make an inquiry about becoming a foster parent.
Because every kid deserves to be loved unconditionally, even when their future is uncertain.
We're the grown-ups. We can do that.
And every kid is worth it.